So I missed last week. And I meant to ask Kate what she talked about, and I forgot to talk about that in the car, coming here.
Not knowing is the most intimate.
Not knowing is most intimate. Oh, good. Perfect. Because I thought tonight I talk about on the koan of relationship. So let me begin with a koan, one of these Zen stories. Again, Chinese, right? Long Tan made rice cakes for a living, but when he met the priest Tian Huang, he left home to follow him. Tian Huang said, "Be my attendant. From now on, I will teach you the essential Dharma gate." And after a year, Long Tan said, "When I arrived, you said you would teach me, but so far, nothing has happened." Tian Huang said, "I've been teaching you all along." And then Long Tan replied, "What have you been teaching me?" And Tian Huang said, "When you greet me, I bow. When I sit, you stand beside me. When you bring tea, I receive it." That's the koan. I'll explore that a little bit more in a moment. So in the Zen tradition, I think as maybe most of us know, koan, the Zen tradition uses koan as a way to open our view about who we are and how we relate to the world. Koan started in China, probably around the 800s, and they were originally just a collection of short stories or special events that happened that were recorded. Maybe even just a brief conversation between a student and a teacher, or sometimes between two students. And then over several hundred years, the collections were formalized, and poetry was added, and commentaries added. And the Zen monasteries of East Asia came to use these as aids for study and practice. The word itself, the word koan, literally means a public case in the legal sense of setting a legal precedent that will guide future decisions. Now, koans are not intended to describe something to us or to teach us something even, but rather invite us to open our lives to the truth that is already there. Koans provoke and challenge because they cannot be understood by reason and logic. A koan points directly at reality, free of our views, assumptions, and our projections. So as a religious practice, complete understanding of a koan involves an individual experience. You must experience the koan. But that experience is actually beyond the individual, beyond you, and actually is an opening up to the collective, to the non-dual, or to interbeing, to use Thich Nhat Hanh's phrase. So these koan collections that we have today come mostly from the Song Dynasty, which is roughly from about 950 to 1200. And they relate, you know, early stories and events from the monastic tradition in China. So as a result, these collections don't deal with many of the issues that we face as non-monastics. So like, there aren't any koans really dealing with romance or family issues, sex, work, children. But actually, that's okay. Because life provides us with one koan after another in these areas. These koan naturally appear out of the dilemmas that we face and the troubling situations we find ourselves in. Now, I don't mean that we should call all our practical dilemmas, like how to find a new job, how to deal with an overdue bill. I don't mean that these are koans, but rather the times of a time of crisis, perhaps, that arises when a loved one dies, or when our partner decides to leave the relationship, or our child is chronically ill. Or maybe just at a time when we are lost in our life, sitting rudderless in a boat, floating. How do I live my life now? What is the purpose of this? How can this be? What will enable me to remain upright here? How do I bear this suffering, this grief? Life gives us these kind of questions. It gives us these profound koans at one time or another. And these questions that arise have no easy answer, and maybe no practical answer at all. And yet, we may find the tenacity to stay with the question that arises with the attending sorrow and confusion until the question resolves. If we can stay with a koan life gives us, it becomes a way of getting us out of our constricted sense of self. Not by denying that self, but by growing it. We grow who we are so that our sense of self no longer has the limited meaning that it once had. But this is not easy. Here's a description in one of those collections called the Mumonkan, the early Chinese collections, about how hard it is to work with a koan. And this is a description about working with the koan Mu. So here's what's written in that text. If you want to pass this barrier, this Mu, you want to understand Mu, you must work through every bone in your body, through every pore in your skin, filling it with this question. What is Mu? And carry it night and day. Do not believe it is the common negative symbol meaning nothing, which is the literal meaning of Mu. It is not nothingness, the opposite of existence. If you really want to pass this barrier, you should feel like swallowing a hot iron ball that you can neither swallow nor spit out. Wow. Isn't it the case that sometimes in the midst of a troubling relationship, it feels like you swallowed a hot iron ball that you cannot swallow or spit out? Sometimes we're given no choice. As some of you know, I had an elder brother who was an alcoholic and who also abused prescription drugs. David stopped working in his 40s, got divorced, and basically lived out the rest of his life on social existence. He died when he was in his early 50s. He was also a chronic manipulator, judgmental of others, and a liar, which often comes with the territory if you're alcoholic. I was often very angry with David and I didn't like him very much. But he was my brother. And despite the harm that he did to the family, I didn't cut him off. But I was glad he lived in a different city. Lived in Calgary rather than Vancouver. And looking back now, I can see that for me, there were two koans that I was struggling with. One was, who is this person? I didn't know who he was. And the other koan that I struggled with was, how can I be upright now and relate to him? So while David was alive, I struggled consciously and unconsciously with these questions or variations of them, but I never sadly resolved them. Or maybe I should say, they never resolved themselves. I could not and did not find a place, a space, that allowed me to open and be with David for very long. I could not fix him. Although now, I think if he were still alive, maybe we could be loving brothers again. My struggle when dealing with David was that I could not be present without the many strong grievances and painful stories pressing in on me. When he greeted me, I did not bow. Most of my anger and passions, mostly I guess I should say, my anger, my passions directed my speech and my actions. And so that at the end of our phone conversations and also our face-to-face meetings, I felt unseen, unheard, and my needs unmet. I did not know how to invoke patience and tolerance. And I failed in deeply knowing and appreciating David. When he brought tea, I did not receive it. Isn't it true, often the struggles and problems experienced by our acquaintances and friends and the solutions to those problems and struggles seem so clear to us, while our own problems and struggles remain so opaque? And this is especially regarding relationships. For most of us, the wounds and confusion we've accumulated have ossified into reactions and are quickly triggered by sights or misunderstandings, snubs, real or imagined. I mentioned earlier that koan help us open to the collective, to the non-duality or the interbeing of all things. Some teachers use the phrase big mind, that we open to a spaciousness. And Suzuki Roshi has a great quote about this that I'm just going to give you now. He says, big mind experiences everything within itself. Do you understand the difference between the two minds? The mind which includes everything and the mind which is related to something? Your attitude towards your life will be different according to which understanding you have. It's just like clear water with a few waves. Actually, water always has waves. Waves are the practice of the water. To speak of waves apart from water or water apart from waves is delusion. Water and waves are one. So what has this got to do with relationship? Suzuki Roshi is telling us that there is something larger than our typical view of duality. Beyond that view, there is a ground of inclusiveness. And sometimes we may experience this in our zazen, or sometimes out in nature when we're hiking. But what about the strained and painful moments in a relationship? Can we see the inclusiveness there? Can we see it's all water? When tossed about by the waves, how do we open to the clear, vast water that is supporting all relationships? So the Buddhist tradition, I think, offers us some guidance. Now, first is the intention to take refuge in a more spacious view of relationship. Or maybe I should say, maybe all our relationships have a spacious view. But how do we do that? How do we open up to a relationship? Well, in the Buddhist canon or collection of texts, there are various groups of practices kind of clumped together that offer practitioners help to open to a more inclusive and a more complete view. And one of these collections are the six paramitas, or the six perfections. And now there are many ways, I think, to we could talk about these qualities and how they can be practiced in the ground of relationship. But I'd like us to consider just a few of them. I'll just mention a few. So the six paramitas are, let me just list them first. Generosity, ethical conduct, patience, energy, meditation, and wisdom. So let's see how we do here. So the first paramita is generosity. So in terms of relationship, generosity is not about denying your own needs. But when we give our time, attention, and understanding, or maybe even do just a little bit more than our share, our tight view of ourself opens up a little. It softens. And of course, every relationship has ruptures and disagreements. And generosity, the intention of generosity, I think, includes forgiveness for a promise forgotten, maybe a complaint that feels like an unfair criticism, or at least the intention to forgive, even if you can't forgive at that moment. You can say, may tomorrow I be able to forgive you. But right now, no. But perhaps the most important act of forgiveness is to forgive your partner or your friend for not matching your ideal. With this paramita, we again and again set our intention to generously see the person as they are, rather than measuring them up against an ideal that we have. The next paramita is ethical conduct, or sometimes ethical self-discipline. And this is, it's pretty clear, is the practice of refraining from destructive behavior. Behavior that hurts you or it hurts other people in some way. And so much about this could be said in the connection of relationships. But I think the essence would be a commitment to be kind in word and action, and to avoid that which will cause harm. Kind speech, fidelity, truthfulness, and not harming oneself or the other person are some examples, of course. We commit to being morally upright throughout our life, knowing that this will help us avoid some of the most painful pitfalls in relationships and deepen a sense of trust and acceptance of each other's flaws, all in the context of the greater view of the other and of yourself. I'm going through these rather quickly. We could spend a whole night on each one. So, patience is the next paramita. Now, I suppose the immediate response is to think of, you know, patience with the other's foibles. He never picks up his socks, etc. But while, of course, that's important to be patient, perhaps the greater practice is patience and tolerance with yourself. How quickly we can assign blame, to ourselves or to others. The practice of patience is in part a willingness to be with your own failings, a willingness to take responsibility for our own emotional reactions. Our sitting practice is the forge where we face the real pain of feeling inadequate, judged, unappreciated, devalued, or any other kind of afflictive emotions or thoughts. We sit there, we allow them to come, we watch them, we allow them to go. In our sitting practice, we slowly mature. We allow those thoughts and feelings to arise and dissipate without getting lost in them or without lashing out. That's the practice of patience. Energy is the fourth paramita. Now, you may remember way back, for those of you who are here, I mentioned in my first talk about relationships that relationships don't work, that relationships take work. I thought that was kind of cute. I just want to throw it in again. If we seek relationship as a refuge from our life, we will be disappointed. Energy or effort in the context of the paramitas is not just about making a wholehearted endeavor, which of course is important in a relationship. We try, we put effort into it. But this paramita is about showing up. Showing up when a relationship is sweet and juicy, and showing up when you or the other person is stressed, grumpy, depressed, distracted, or dying. Showing up means to connect with some tenderness and kindness, and asking yourself, who is this person right now? Who am I right now? So energy is not about fixing or making better. It's about attention, interest, opening up to the many facets of this person right before you. The next paramita is meditation. Now we all know the practice of meditation, taking our seat, bringing awareness to the body and breath, resting in the present moment. And when the mind strays, We gently bring it back to right here and now. When we bring this practice to relationship, it is a great act of generosity. We return to our body, our breath, the present moment, and our deep caring for the person, even if they just burnt the toast for the third time this week. Using the tools that we have honed in the meditation practice, we apply them to those cool times of disconnect and distance, to the hot times of anger and resentment, and even to the bitter times of mistrust and hurt. In meditation practice, we taste the present moment of our life without evaluation and judgment, returning to the present moment when in dialogue with another person, we taste the relationship without evaluation and judgment. For a moment or two, even, we just open to the other, giving them and ourselves the gift of presence and full attention. And really, what could be more intimate? The final paramita is the paramita of wisdom. And usually we associate wisdom with knowing. Right? Teacher knows everything. Wisdom. But I would like us to consider the wisdom of not knowing. So while I have some general understanding of Kate, after having lived with her, living together for over 3 decades, when I assume that I know what's going on between us, or know what's going on in her, I fail the relationship. I don't think long-term intimate relationships can be understood, because that kind of relationship is beyond a place of knowing. Like all things, it is a dynamic flow of unceasing change. Wisdom is meeting the other in that place. Wisdom is meeting the other in that place of groundlessness, like the flowing river. So what does this mean, practically? Well, like our Zazen practice, when the mind wanders off and or we miss a few days of practice, or maybe a few weeks, or maybe even years, and we come back, we just begin again. Who is this person? Disengaging the assumptions, the views, and understandings of what a relationship should be, what I think it is, and has been, we begin again. We begin again. So those are the 6 paramitas, and a few suggestions about how they may connect to relationship. Maybe you have more ideas or views. But I hope practicing the 6 paramitas will help us see the deep, clear waters of relationship along with the waves when they hit us. So I think I'll stop there. And I thought tonight I'd like us to do a little bit of writing first before we get into groups and talk. And I have two questions for you. First one is a little bit intimate. What is the koan of relationship for you right now? I gave you the example of my brother. What is the koan of relationship for you right now? And you can write this down, and you don't have to share it if it feels too something else. But again, of course, connected to relationship. And then, which one of the paramita speaks to you, and how does it? The six that I mentioned. I'll review them once I hand out the paper for you, just in case you don't have them on the tip of your tongue. Okay? So we'll take a few minutes and just, jot down your thoughts, your feelings quickly, and then we'll take a few moments just to share as well. So, and pens. I'll pass this one on the side. Do you have a pen?